Good morning. We're going to get started at the Senate Committee on Judiciary, and we're starting off with work sessions. Thank you very much. The lawnmower is now stopped. We're going to start off our work sessions, and we're going to start with Senate Bill 543.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 543 is the ACLU anti-SLAPP suit law, and we adopted the Dash 2 amendments on April 7th, and we're waiting for the paperwork. It has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're waiting on what?
We were waiting for the fiscal, okay. And we got it.
All right.
Minimal.
So the chair will take a motion to move the bill as amended to the floor.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 543 to the floor, as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Roland Meachie moves Senate Bill 543 as amended by the Dash 2 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And do I have a volunteer as a carrier on this one? Senator Dingfelder will be our carrier. And Senator Boquist is excused from this vote. He is in transit, got caught up on some other stuff. So we'll close the work session on 543, open the work session on 745.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 745 is the bill we heard last week on April 10th. It allows attorney fees for claims based on express or implied contract, regardless of whether the prevailing party was a party to the contract. This was for identity theft type cases. It has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact and no amendments. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 745 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Bolden Meachie moves Senate Bill 745 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And we'll have Senator Bolden Meachie be our carrier on this one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I am going to. And I'm going to open up Senate Bill 570 just to make an announcement. We are still waiting for the fiscals on this. Hopefully it will be here tomorrow because we're going to carry it over again. So it will be set for tomorrow, Thursday, April 16th. With that, we'll close the work session. And I apologize to everyone in the room. I should have said Happy Tax Day. So hopefully everyone has got their taxes done. Remember, you have until 11:59 p.m. to make the deadline. With that, we're going to go ahead and open up our public hearing and possible work session with the public hearing at this point on Senate Bill 874.
Mr. Chair is going to say we really need their money, so I just want to make sure they get it in on time.
We're encouraging everyone to pay at the door on their way out.
And Mr. Chair, I don't know if everyone recognizes, but yesterday was Be Nice to Lawyers Day.
I missed that.
That was yesterday.
Yeah, one day a year.
That's gotcha. Yeah.
The other 364
were adolescents. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 874 updates the Americans with Disability Act, ADA. It provides criteria for determining whether an individual has a physical and or mental impairment that substantially limits one or more of the individual's major life activities. It provides examples of major life activities. There's a Dash 1 amendment, and that amendment defines state government and adds to the list of activities and functions that are considered major life activities. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. We have Bob Estabrook, Bob Jindeth, and Liz McGannon, I believe. Will y'all come forward, please? Whoever wants to get started.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Bob Estabrook from the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries, here today in support of Senate Bill 874 with the Dash 1 amendment, which clarifies a couple of issues that were not quite perfected in the original draft of the bill. The two things that we're doing here under the umbrella of conforming to the new ADA Amendments Act. There are basically two changes from existing law. One of them is greater clarity around the idea of a major life activity. You'll note in the bill and also in the amendment a more specific, more comprehensive list of the major life activities that qualify an individual as disabled. The other key piece is the change that an individual is to be viewed in their unmitigated condition for determining whether or not they are disabled, but mitigating measures do not necessarily make an individual not disabled for the purposes of this law. The reason that BOLI is here, in addition to the importance of our conformance with federal law, on the one point is simply that it creates greater clarity for employers to have consistency between state and federal law. It puts us in a difficult position as the enforcement agency to have two different standards, certainly, but it's also difficult for employers to have inconsistent language between those two laws. And I think that the real impact of these changes are to refocus the discussion about disability protection away from a little bit the question of whether or not an individual is disabled and focus more on the interactive process and what a reasonable accommodation might be rather than focusing in on that definition of disability. And we have some great experts here to talk about this law, so I'll just keep my testimony to that. But I thank the committee for your consideration and hope that Senate Bill 874 and the Dash 1 amendments can be moved forward.
All right, thank you.
Disability Rights Oregon, and we're speaking in support of Senate Bill 874. Just some quick history. The state of Oregon has had statutes and laws that provide protection for people with disabilities from discrimination for over 20 years. In 1990, the federal government took action in this area and enacted the Americans with Disabilities Act. And that act provides protection from discrimination for people with disabilities in the areas of employment, in public accommodations, in state services, and transportation services. That added to protections for people with disabilities in the area of housing that are otherwise protected in federal law. Shortly after the enactment of that law, this legislature sat down and looked at potential changes to the state laws. And Neil Bryant was then chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and I worked with him and many other representatives of advocacy groups and citizens and business sat down. And the message was that which we wanted to make the state laws consistent as possible with the federal law, so that there's a single standard that all players could look to in terms of knowing what their obligations are and what their rights are. And that's what we came in with. In the intervening years, there's been various interpretations on the federal level of the ADA. There's been some court decisions by the U.S. Supreme Court that have interpreted the law and some agency decisions, particularly the EEOC, has made some interpretations of the federal law that in some Congress was not comfortable with. And over the past 2 years, Congress worked on a bill to clarify their original intent in terms of what the ADA meant when they passed it. And the result of that was that Congress passed the Americans with Disabilities Amendments Act, unfortunately called the ADAAA, which makes some fairly limited but significant changes to the original law to clarify what its meaning was in terms of who a person with disabilities is and how that decision should be determined. And that bill, having been passed, we are now coming to you to try to do what Oregon has done now since for about 15, 16 years, which is to try to make these laws as consistent as possible so that we have a single standard for the area of discrimination against people with disabilities.
Great. Thank you very much. And Liz?
Liz McKenna here testifying on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I'm an attorney in private practice. I've practiced, I'd say, over 30 years now, and some of that practice has been on behalf of employers. I served as an in-house counsel for a major corporation, but I also represent employees now. And I think my perspective is really looking at both sides. This is has been a bipartisan effort all along in Congress and in Oregon. It's one of the broadest bills in some ways because everyone sitting in this room could be affected by it at some point. Unfortunately, we all could be subject to fall to a disability and need these accommodations when you need them so you can stay working, so you can be employed and have the respect of having a job. It is critical that the employer work with you in an interactive process and come up with a way to develop reasonable accommodations. So I think it's such an important bill. We want to keep it one that can be useful. And I regularly, daily, talk with employees and sometimes employers about how do we accommodate a person. And there is much accommodation that occurs and has occurred under the bill and under the old act, federal act and under Oregon law. But where the hang-up comes and why these amendments are critical is that it's not about typically the accommodation that will work. It's when an employer looks at the statute, the federal statute as it did exist, and says, gee, I'm not sure if that employee fits within this very narrow definition of being substantially limited by one or more major life activities. And most of the litigation that has resulted, and we know litigation can be protracted, expensive, and really focus on the wrong thing, most of it has been about, is the person fitting within this narrow window? You often find if people can fit into that, they may be too disabled to even work. If they're outside of it, they are disabled, they need accommodations, but somehow they haven't been, what they need to show, they haven't shown that they are substantially limited, and that's been interpreted as almost totally restricted from performing one or more major life activities. And I think if we can shift the focus, which is what these amendments are intended to do, shift the focus to whether or not the person should be accommodated, and if we have consistency with the federal law, we will all be able to solve the problems, that is, employers and employees on a much more local level, and not have the protracted litigation that's gone on for the last 15 years and made employers and employees unsure of whether they will qualify as disabled so they can have these benefits, have these reasonable accommodations. The accommodations don't turn out to be very expensive. They're practical solutions. If they're too expensive, the employer can say, we need, that's an undue hardship, we simply can't do it. And if there's litigation, maybe that's where the litigation should be, but not on the question of whether somebody is disabled when you have such a narrow window. And this is exactly what the Congress had said. We want these amendments so we can shift the focus to where it ought to be. Do you need accommodation, and what should that be? We can have more people gainfully employed rather than having to rely on insurance benefits or the state or federal funding. They now can be working, and that's been the goal of this act. It's an exceptional act, but it needs to be improved and in sync with the federal law, and therefore I urge you to pass this All right. legislation. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Questions? Start with Senator Wissett.
Chair Brzezinski, It's my understanding that the ADA applies to employees with 15 or more employees, and Oregon law currently applies to 6 or more employees. So in the spirit of conforming Oregon and federal law, would the three of you agree to an amendment to increase Oregon's compliance to 15 employees?
Senator Whitsitt, I wouldn't presume to speak for the agency or our commissioner without consulting, but I...
You are here.
Since I am here, I don't know that we would be in favor of doing that because I think it would be a rollback of existing protection, which is not something that the Bureau historically has been comfortable doing. I think that these amendments in Senate Bill 874 do provide an increased protection, which we think is important to the folks that are going to be covered.
The short answer is no, then.
Currently.
Mr. Chair, Senator Witt said the short answer would be no.
He's looking for his lifeline. Liz, did you have something?
Well, just in comparison, the other discrimination laws do not even have the six employee minimum requirement. They, if you have one employee, you can't discriminate. Mm. And this is a form of discrimination. And so I think the six was kind of a compromise between this and the federal requirement of 15. But it seems to have worked. I don't...
I think that it's certainly an employer with six employees
should be able to figure out a way to accommodate. I think where they might argue about that, I'd say it's an undue hardship because we have so few employees. And that would be, I believe, with all due respect, a better way to address it.
All right, other questions?
Just yes. To follow up by a comment, Mr. Chair, the way this definitions in this bill are written, who among us here sitting at the desk isn't impaired? I mean, we could, some people in this room, I would think that's could consider any one of us impaired in the matter of clear thinking, ability to reason, and
based
certainly
on the emails I'm getting, I think that qualifies.
And certainly perceived mental impairment.
All right. Other questions or comments?
Senator Romichi. Thank you, Bob. Mr. Junda, because there's two Bobs. You said in your written testimony that California and Washington have more comprehensive protections against disability discrimination than Oregon. Have they had problems in implementing their more comprehensive protections that we should be aware of?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, I'm not aware of problems. Well, I guess the question is, when you're speaking of problems, who are you referring to having problems, I guess would be my question. Because
I guess my sense is if their protections are more comprehensive, what is it that they have that we aren't including in this bill, and is there a reason why we haven't included more comprehensive protections?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, I believe it's really a matter of policy. Oregon has followed a policy of trying to keep our discrimination laws as close as possible to the federal laws. In both California and Washington, they have gone beyond that in covering anybody with a disability. That disability doesn't have to affect a major life activity. And that's really the limitation, moving over to Senator Witsit's question, because the law really is narrowed to people who can't perform major life activities. And as someone who follows this area of law, it's a fairly limited definition, even under the new law. In Washington and California, they don't have that limitation. But remember, this only prohibits discrimination based upon that particular disability. And discrimination means that the person is treated differently because of that disability than they would if they didn't have it. So in other words, the effect of it is a little bit different than some other discrimination laws. So to sum up, I'm not aware that there have been major problems as a result of having those different standards. And that is why, actually, our organization would advocate for broadening that definition.
Thank you.
Hang on one second. Let me just check this side. Any questions? All right. Senator West says.
Just to follow up on that, on page 1, line 20, section 2, sub A, an individual is regarded as having a physical or mental impairment if the individual has been subjected to an action prohibited because of an actual or perceived physical or mental impairment, whether or not the impairment limits or is perceived to limit a major life activity of the individual.
That is a particular part of the law dealing with the perception of disability. And what the ADA protects is not only discrimination against people who have disabilities, but those who are perceived to have disabilities. So, in other words, if I happen to think that you have epilepsy, even though you don't, the law says that I am not supposed to discriminate against you because you have epilepsy or I think you have epilepsy. There's also a limitation that says that an employer does not have to provide a reasonable accommodation for somebody who has a perceived disability. So in other words, you don't have to make up an accommodation just because you wrongfully think a person has a disability. So it's a fairly narrow category, and it's designed to pick up on those situations in which, say, an employer believes that somebody is suffering from a particular disorder or that it's severe, and they don't really have that. However, that the employer takes an adverse action against that person based upon their own belief that is unsubstantiated.
All right.
Then, if I if the employee perceives themselves to, if the employee perceive you, my employer, to believe that you have taken discrimination against me because I'm depressed, does it make any difference or not whether I really am depressed? Clinically?
I'm sorry, Senator Pozanski, Senator Whitsett, I wasn't quite sure what the question was.
If I, as your employee, perceive myself to be depressed and that I perceive that you, my employer, has discriminated against me because you perceive that I'm depressed, does it necessarily mean that I have to be have a clinical diagnosis of depression in order to carry that forward, or is it perception good enough?
Senator Pozanski, Senator Whitsett, no, perception is not good enough. In order to obtain a accommodation for a disability, an employee would have to demonstrate that they have a disability to the satisfaction of the employer, and that will normally mean some type of clinical evidence. And then the employer and the employee, from that point forward, is supposed to undergo a conversation, enter into a conversation in which they try to ascertain what types of steps might be necessary in order for that employee to be able to do the job. And if that employee can do the job with what's called a reasonable accommodation, some minor change to the workplace to accommodate that disability, then the employer gets to make that call in terms of what is reasonable and appropriate and make that offer to the employee. So perceptions alone are not good enough.
Anything else?
And then the Bureau of Labor and Industries would determine whether that was reasonable or not.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsett, when a complaint is filed with BOLI for any kind of civil rights violation, disability or otherwise, there is a burden of proof on the complainant to show that the basis of the adverse employment action or the or if there was a failure to make a reasonable accommodation, that complainant does have to make some showing of evidence that the complaint is founded. We have an investigation process to determine that, and then once an investigation would be conducted, we would make a determination about whether a violation of the law had occurred.
Thank you.
All right, anything else? Thank you all very much. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 874?
And members of the committee. I'm Marcia Olemiller. I'm the legal policy advisor for BOLI, and I was listening to the discussion just now. I just wanted to make a clarification about a question that was presented by Senator Whitsett. I actually had a really fortunate experience of working on the federal ADA when it was first enacted in Washington, D.C. I was working there at the time and then came back to Oregon in time for Oregon to modify its disability law to match the original ADA, and I followed the process all the way through. And I can tell you that Oregon disability law has always covered employers with six or more employees, even prior to the enactment of the federal ADA in 1990. And I believe that was, at the time, it was in the original Oregon disability law was kind of partnered with discrimination law protecting injured workers and former injured workers, which was also the threshold with six or more employees. So when the Oregon legislature revisited Oregon law in 1996 to match it with the federal ADA that was passed in 1990, they opted to retain the number of six rather than changing to the federal threshold of 15 employees. And I will say also that other protected classes under Chapter 659A of the ORS begin at one employee or more. That is race, gender, and all of the usual list of protected classes that we think of in civil rights law. So I just wanted to give that bit of background about where the number six fits in and why it has been retained. I'll take any questions if there are any.
Thank you. My purpose in asking the question was that was my understanding that this bill was brought forward primarily to conform with federal ADA. And if we're going to conform with federal ADA, let's conform with it.
And that is an excellent question. And I will say that the legislature, when they were deliberating on this issue in 1996, they opted to retain the, in some cases, stronger protections that were already existent in Oregon law rather than to reduce those to match the ADA. They said, we don't want to roll back any protections that already exist in Oregon law. Oregon's fortunate in that we actually were the pioneers in a number of areas of employment protections, including disability law. And we already had some things that were actually stronger than the ADA, and I think the legislature has opted to retain those.
We have. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right. Any other comments, questions? Anyone else that wanted to give testimony? If not, I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 874. Colleagues, this is one of those unique opportunities. Not only do we have an amendment, not only do we have a revenue, but we also have the fiscal all at one time at the first public hearing. So with that, I'm going to open up a work session on 874 and take a motion on the dash ones.
Mr. Chair, move the dash ones into 874.
Senator Boquist moves the dash ones into Senate Bill 874. Any discussion? Any objection? So order.
Mr. Chair, move SB 874 with the dash one to the floor with the due pass.
Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 874 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objections? Note that Senator Wissett is objecting, and with that, that does pass. And I'll carry this one.
I'd prefer if you carry me.
Yeah, I'll carry this.
I do have the same concerns he had, but we're not going to change 615 or whatever. So move on.
Chair will carry 874, and we'll close that public work session, I should say, on 874. We're now going to move into other public hearings, and for all those who are here, hopefully those that are attorneys, you're going to get to have the experience that we get to have, and that is we're going to start off with Senate Bill 636. Now, I'm opening up a public hearing as we bring in our new counsel. This is kind of a continuation of you who were here before when we had the UCC presentation, and everyone kind of remember back to law school. Well, we're going back to law school for those who actually took the courses in trademark, service marks, and trade names. So with that, Lisa, if you'd be so kind, thank you very much for joining us and give us an overview of what enticing information we'll be hearing on Senate Bill 636.
Senate Bill 636 updates Oregon law related to trademarks, service marks, and trade names. It brings Oregon statutes in line with federal law and 2007 revisions to the Model State Trademark Bill. I've hand-engrossed bills in front of you with the Dash 1 amendments. They were also put in by the original proponents, and they just clarify their original intent with this legislation. You also have a letter of support from Intel in your packets.
All right, great. And I have four people that are scheduled to testify, so if we can bring up an extra chair, we'll just bring everyone up together. And is it Tina Beatty, Walters, Ann Gessler, Tom Walsh, and Marion Haynes. And as they're coming forward, colleagues, I'll just say the reason I wanted to introduce this as I did in my previous life when I worked for a law firm in Houston as a legal assistant, one of the areas I was assigned to was patents and utilities, so I had the opportunity to do patents and trademark work there. Yes. So kind of back to memory lane. All right, whoever wanted to get started, if you'll identify yourself, and we'll take it from there.
Chair Pozanski and members of the committee, my name is Christina Beatty Walters. I'm an attorney from Portland, the firm Stoll Burn. My firm is a member of the International Trademark Association, and I'm a member of the Model State Trademark Bill Subcommittee, and it's in that capacity that I appear before you today to testify in favor of Senate Bill 636 with the -1 amendments. I intend to summarize my written testimony today by giving a brief introduction to the bill and describing its history. My colleague, sitting to my direct right, Ann Glazer, will testify a little bit more fully about what the bill does. The current Oregon trademark statute is based on a decades-old version of the Model State Trademark Bill drafted by the International Trademark Association, which is abbreviated often as INTA. INTA is a worldwide membership organization comprised of over 5,000 member companies and law firms dedicated to supporting and advancing trademarks. Oregon's trademark law is largely based on the 1949 version of the Model State Trademark Bill. Over the years, as federal trademark law has developed and changed, INTA has amended the Model Bill, most recently in 1992, 1996, and 2007. Senate Bill 636 with the -1 amendments is based on the most recent model bill, the 2007 version. About 30 states have adopted the most modern versions of the model bill, including California, Washington, and Idaho. Oregon's trademark law is out of step at this point and just needs to be updated. I'll leave the detail about what the bill would do to my colleague, Ms. Glazer, but let me say that Senate Bill 636 with the -1 amendments would modernize and significantly clarify Oregon law, Oregon trademark law. Among other things, it would harmonize Oregon law with federal dilution principles, clarify trademark registration standards, and create a scheme for cancellation of trademarks. I'd like to explain a little bit about how it is that Senate Bill 636 before you was created. With the help of the Oregon State Bar, a diverse working group of 15 trademark attorneys and trademark professionals was assembled to study the 2007 Model State Trademark Bill and the proposed changes it would make to Oregon law. The working group notably included a representative of the Secretary of State and a representative of the Oregon Department of Justice. The working group did not agree to the wholesale adoption of the 2007 Model State Trademark Bill, but instead proposed and agreed upon several changes to the 2007 Model Bill. Many of the changes were, in fact, in response to concerns voiced by the Secretary of State's office. In the end of the lengthy review process conducted by the working group voted to approve the revised version of the 2007 Model Bill. That revised version was submitted to Legislative Council and became Senate Bill 636. We requested that the -1 amendments be drafted to better reflect the intent of the bill as submitted, and we ask that the -1 amendments be adopted. We have gathered and continue to gather business support for the bill. I have submitted written testimony from Jonathan Williams of Intel Corporation in support of the bill with the -1 amendments, and I can also say that Columbia Sportswear and Norm Thompson support the bill with the -1 amendments. Ms. Glazer has included with her materials additional letters of support from some other businesses that she'll mention. We also understand that the bill with the -1 amendments will have no or a minimal fiscal impact. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and we'd be happy to answer questions.
All right, thank you. We'll take all the testimony, and then we'll open up for some compelling questions, I assure you. And I should give a warning here. If members have been following who has been assigned as carriers, there are two people that have not been assigned a bill today. So y'all might want to be listening very closely here. All right, who's next?
Chair Pozanski and members of the committee, my name is Ann Glazer. I'm a partner with the Stoll Reeves Law Firm in Portland, and my firm is a member of INTA as well. And I'm a member here, really, as a member of INTA's Model State Trademark Bill Subcommittee. In my practice, I represent the full range of Oregon businesses and regional businesses, from public companies to one-person startups and everything in between. I appear before you to testify on behalf of INTA in support of SB 636 with the -1 amendment. We've obtained letters of support, as Tina mentioned, from representatives of four Oregon companies so far, copies of which are attached to my written testimony. The letters of business support that we have in hand were sent by the president of Norm Thompson Outfitters, the president and owner of Pavia Wines and Events, Vice President of Stash Tea and Vice President of Kakadu Traders Australia. We've also included a detailed letter of support from Michael Heilbronner, who was in our work group and is a solo practitioner serving small trademark owners primarily. Mike is also an adjunct professor of trademark law at Lewis and Clark Law School and a former in-house counsel for Adidas America handling trademarks. He strongly supports this bill as an advancement in our trademark law and one that will benefit his small business clients, so we did want to draw attention to his statement. I would like to tell you some more about the purpose and substance of SB 636. It makes a large number of large and small changes to Oregon's trademark statute, and we are very aware that the committee's time is limited, so we'll keep it at a high level and take questions.
Foot.
Yes.
And whoever's the carrier will be probably contacting you for all those ins and outs for the floor discussion.
Great.
Good bill should pass.
If I don't get to 40,000 foot, it might be a no vote, and I don't have to care.
First, it is important to place the bill in context. Trademarks, as Tina mentioned, they're words, names, symbols, devices that are used to identify and distinguish goods and services. They're entirely different scheme of law from copyrights and patents. In fact, those two areas are governed almost entirely by federal law. Trademark is governed by a mix of federal and state law, but the Federal Lanham Trademark Act does generally hold the field in trademark law and practice. The state trademark statutes, in comparison to the federal law, are relatively little used, frankly, but they still play a very important role in trademark practice and jurisprudence.
For example, state registration for trademarks is available at a much lower cost than federal registration, and it is available for purely local businesses, for example, with a hair salon that
may not qualify for federal registration. State infringement claims are available under the current statute for the enforcement of state registered marks. And finally, state trademark dilution claims are available for well-known marks. We'll talk a little bit more about that. First, a key feature of this bill is that it expresses the intent to provide a trademark system that is substantially consistent with the federal trademark system. Courts are expressly guided by this bill to treat federal case law as persuasive authority for interpreting a state statute, so that will be a change. There are very few state cases decided under the state trademark statute, so this should help provide greater guidance and predictability for courts and litigants, and will also increase harmonization of the trademark laws across the country with one another and with the federal law. Oregon's trademark statute covers three major areas. The first is trademark registration. Second is civil infringement actions and remedies. And the third is civil actions for dilution of well-known marks. I'll briefly touch on each of these areas and how they're affected by the bill. First,
and
yes.
Seriously, what we do need to do is kind of give us just a quick overview.
Yes.
Since we have your written testimony, we will be going over it, so we don't need to go through it line by line.
Thank you. The Secretary of State issues trademark registrations to individuals and companies who apply. The bill will not significantly change trademark registration practice, and this is an area where there are a lot of small changes. So we'll make several improvements to Oregon's registration scheme. The key point here is that we worked closely with the Secretary of State's office and others to ensure that these provisions would be workable and acceptable for everyone. Second, the current law provides damages for counterfeits or imitations of a registered trademark, a state registered trademark, in the greater of statutory minimum of $10,000 or up to triple damages and three times the defendant's profits. The bill changes this scheme by removing the $10,000 statutory minimum and providing for an awards of attorney's fees in cases of bad faith or for other good reason. Importantly, the bill also adds a fair use defense to protect defendants against claims of trademark infringement in situations where the defendant had a free speech right to use a descriptive term descriptively or to use a mark accurately and fairly to refer to the trademark goods or to the trademark owner. So that's the infringement and remedies area. The third area is dilution. The bill completely overhauls Oregon's dilution law. This is the area where there's been the greatest amount of change over the years. Briefly, dilution is the use of a famous mark in a way that impairs its distinctiveness. Can be a very difficult concept to understand even for trademark professionals. Dilution can be controversial, frankly, partly for that reason, but everyone in the working group reached a comfort level with the changes that the bill will bring in this area. With that, I'd be pleased to go into greater detail on any of the points we've mentioned so far, if the committee's interested. Thank you for hearing my testimony, and I'd be pleased to answer questions.
Great. Thank you. And whoever's going to go next.
Thank you, Chairman Brzezinski, members of the committee. My name is Tom Rausch. I'm the Commercial Registries Manager of the Secretary of State's Office in the Corporation Division, and you have my written testimony, so I'll keep my remarks very brief. I'm basically here just to explain to you the fiscal impact you probably see before you. Senate Bill 636, as originally drafted, it came out of the committee, isn't what you see before you at 636. The dash ones are. And the dash ones generally have to do with our stuff, the Secretary of State's provisions that match and meet the type of things we need to modernize the trademark registration and give customers a service that they're used to having. So therefore, you see 636, there's a significant fiscal impact. 636-1 amendments, there's no fiscal impact at all. And that's because those changes were made. And thank you. I'll be happy to take any questions you have.
Great. Thank you, Mary.
Good morning, Chair of the committee. My name is Marion Haynes. I'm with the Oregon Business Association. OBA supports Senate Bill 636 with the dash one amendments as necessary to modernize Oregon's trademark statutes. Our member businesses rely on trademark protection and will benefit from updating Oregon's currently outdated statute based on the 2007 Model State Trademark Bill. The dash one amendments provide several important changes, bringing Oregon trademark laws into alignment with federal laws is important, particularly for those companies that are engaged in interstate commerce, and the updates to the infringement remedies, dilution protection, and registration procedures will also be of a great benefit. So we very much support the dash one amendments, and it's been many years since I took trademark law in law school, so hopefully any questions can be directed to the others on the panel.
Excellent. All right, questions. Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. If maybe the department could expand upon the importance of bringing Oregon statutes in line with federal law and then confirm that legal counsel from your department's reviewed it.
Senator Brzezinski, Senator Boquist, we weren't as much interested in bringing it into line with federal law. That's ANS. And the INTA groups, they know what federal law is. Frankly, I don't. I'm not even a lawyer. We just administer the programs. We take the registrations in and file them and make sure that you're able to get the information you need to find out what trademarks have been filed. And that's what our office is concerned about. It's simply that when they're filed in such a way that you can do it efficiently, that you can retrieve the information efficiently. Possibly, we hope to do electronic filing, for example. We can't under current law. Like I said, the old law was started in 1949. We've changed a lot since 1949 in our office and elsewhere. So we think the dash one amendments really do make great changes to the way we handle the trademarks and accommodate the kinds of business practices that you're used to seeing from the Secretary of State's office.
Well, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So, for the record, Department of Justice was in the work group that came up with this.
Senator Brzezinski, Senator Boquist, that is true.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any other questions? Senator Bill, Von Meacham, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Ann and Tina. Thank you for visiting with me ahead of time to talk about this, and it has to do with the attorney fee provision that's on page 3 of the Dash 1 amendment that amends page 11, line 11. And the way that this is phrased, if the court finds that the plaintiff acted in bad faith, vexatiously, just want to say that word, wantonly or for oppressive reasons, the court in the court's discretion may award reasonable attorney's fees to the defendant. And so my question had to do with just clarifying that because the terms plaintiff and defendant are used in there, would that be interpreted if, for example, the claim is asserted as a counterclaim, is it intended to apply to that situation as well? I just want to clarify that for the record.
Chair Pozanski and Senator Bonamici, thank you for the question. My understanding and looking at the context of Section 15 of Senate Bill 636 is that the term defendant is used consistently throughout that statute. And what that means is that this statute refers to the owner of the mark being the person bringing the case or bringing the claim, as it may be, which may be a counterclaim. So the plaintiff in the Dash 1 amendments refers, we think, to the owner of the trademark bringing the claim, whether it be the person who brings a counterclaim or the actual plaintiff in the litigation. So the defendant in that amendment refers to the defendant on the claim for the damages under the statute.
Thank you. Just want to clarify that.
All right. Any other questions, comments? Thank you all for being here. I appreciate you being here. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 636? All right. We'll go ahead and close the public hearing on 636. My understanding is that we're not ready to move the bill for needing the technical stuff, including the fiscal, even though we understand there won't be one. We still haven't got the paperwork.
That's right.
All right. So we're going to move into our last public hearing that we have scheduled for today, which is Senate Bill 952. I'll go ahead and open up that public hearing at this time.
Senate Bill 952 strengthens the rights of tenants living in properties subject to foreclosure sale. You have Dash 1 amendments that were just delivered this morning to the committee. They're intended to replace the measure by the proponents. They modify the original bill so that still protect a tenant under foreclosure, but it allows that a tenant who has a one-year lease can stay on the property up to 6 months or whenever the lease expires, whichever is earlier, unless the purchaser intends to live on the property, in which case only 30 days notice is required. The amendments also require that tenants receive advance notice of foreclosure proceedings, and they allow tenants to apply any prepaid security deposits towards ongoing rent obligations. It also makes a change in the timeline of eviction notices that are currently triggered before the sale, and it changes those notices to be triggered after the sale to be given by the purchaser of the property.
All right, great. I've got, it looks like, potentially three panels that have signed up. So Sybil Hebb, Patrick Wade, and Ari Rapkin.
Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here today in support of Senate Bill 952-1. The amendments were drafted at our request. Very much appreciate the committee's attention to this issue today and look forward to moving forward with some protections for tenants in homes that are being foreclosed. You are all aware that the foreclosure crisis has nationally had profound implications on the housing market. Locally, of course, we are suffering from the same concern. The impact of the foreclosure crisis on the population of tenants who are renting homes that are going into foreclosure is one that is newly being considered, has so far been left out of the policy discussions here in Oregon, and that's why we have brought Senate Bill 952 move forward. At legal aid offices across the state, we are getting an increasing number of calls from low-income tenants who are concerned and confused and in need of assistance in figuring out how to deal with a circumstance in which their home, for which they have a legitimate rental agreement, is being foreclosed upon. They don't know what their rights are, and they are concerned about their housing stability. And we have discovered in taking those phone calls and in trying to provide assistance to that population that the current law does not do an adequate job of providing those people with protection. So I wanted today to give you a little bit of background as to what we think the current problems are in Oregon law, and then to provide you with an outline of Senate Bill 952 with the amendments. I also want to tell you a little bit about Senate Bill 241 that also has been before this committee and that affects this discussion. So I guess to start off, I wanted to say that with respect to the population of people impacted by foreclosure, we think that tenants are a particularly vulnerable population. They're generally lower income than our homeowners, and when they are faced with the threat of eviction as a result of foreclosure, they have fewer resources available to them and are more at risk of homelessness as a result of losing that home. This issue nationally has impacted low-income communities and minority communities to a greater extent than elsewhere, and so we are concerned about not only the impact on those individual families, we're also concerned about the impact on those neighborhoods. We are seeing now in Oregon that, according to a recent OPB article, that there are 5 foreclosures a day being filed in the city of Bend. This issue and the impact on tenants has been one that has been felt across the state of Oregon. Have attached to my testimony a page listing some sites to articles from Southern Oregon and from Central Oregon and from Portland and from LC, indicating that there are families in those communities who are facing eviction as a result of foreclosure. So it's not only a national problem, it's a very real and local problem. I think that aside from the impact on individual families, the impact on neighborhoods is that when a home goes into foreclosure and a tenant is evicted and is forced to move out, that home often sits vacant, often for months at a time. And so when the homes are vacant, they are not taken care of, they are open to vandalism, the property values in surrounding homes often deteriorate as a result of that, crime rates go up, so the problem is something that spreads out throughout the community, and there are many reasons to try to address and resolve that. With respect to the current law, ORS 86.755 subsection 5 basically provides that the rights of people living in homes that are being foreclosed on, unless they had contracts that were entered into prior to the existence of the mortgage, are essentially extinguished. That's sort of the bulk of the problem. That leads to many specific details that are problematic, and I'll briefly summarize those. Number one, when a foreclosure begins, there is a requirement that a notice be served on the occupants of the home or posted on the home if personal service is not affected. That notice is designed to let everybody know what's going on, but the contents of that notice don't speak to tenants. It's all about how you can get in touch with the lender, how you can figure out how much money you owe, how much money you need to pay in order to save the home for foreclosure. There's information about where to get resources. None of that is pertinent to people who are tenants and don't have any ownership interest in the home. And we'd like to change that so that the notice that is provided is something that has a section that gives some specific and useful information to tenants so that they can learn how to take steps to protect themselves. Often what we find is that when tenants get any inkling that the home is going into foreclosure, the only person they can get to talk to them, if they're lucky, is their landlord, who often will assure them, don't worry about this, it's going to get taken care of, I'm going to resolve it. And so tenant doesn't have any way to get actual effective access to information. So we'd like to resolve that. Another problem that has been identified nationally is that there is no clarity about obligations during the foreclosure time period. Often tenants don't understand whether they are supposed to continue paying rent to their landlords or whether there is some other new additional party that is coming into the process to whom they owe obligations. So and what's going to happen with their security deposit or any prepaid rent. So the numbers of questions are great, and that further shows the need for some notice to tenants that of where they can get information about their rights. Additionally, the notice to vacate the property is something that right now, under current law, can be sent to a tenant living in a home 30 days prior to the sale. So this notice of vacate can be sent by someone who does not yet own the home, but rather who hopes to own the home at a foreclosure sale 30 days down the line. That, as you might imagine, puts tenants into a very difficult and confusing situation. They don't know whether they're continuing to be obligated to pay rent according to their rental agreements to their landlord, or should they pay attention to the notice to vacate from a third party of whom they may never have heard. So they're not sure what their obligations are. Oftentimes what they do is panic and try to move, incurring substantial moving costs disruption to their lives, and we think that's inappropriate because at this point there has not yet been a sale and ownership of the home has not yet transferred. So we would like that the notice of vacate never be sent out until the ownership of the home has actually changed. So the timing of notices is very important. That's also important because, as we've heard from all of the interested parties in this discussion, that there are a small but significant number of homes that get saved right prior to the sale, the foreclosure sale. The landlord, the owner of the home, has the continuing right to try to prevent the foreclosure up until the date of the foreclosure sale. So there is no need for that notice to vacate to go out until you know whether or not the foreclosure has, in fact, gone through. So we'd like to prevent that burden on the tenant and the potential homelessness that comes as a result, if we possibly can. And the sort of next big issue is when, in fact, do tenancies expire? So if you have a legitimate rental agreement right now, if you have a month-to-month agreement or you have a term lease for a period of 6 months, for example, or a period of a year, right now the foreclosure will extinguish either of those rights, all of those rights. And so we would like there to be some protection so that when a notice goes out at the date of a foreclosure sale, that a month-to-month tenant at least gets 30 days notice from that point of sale, and that a person who is in a term lease, who has had some reliance and oftentimes has moved or changed jobs or signed kids up for school in reliance on that stability of housing, extra protection for those people. An additional issue that has come up in this conversation nationally is that this confusion often results in eviction proceedings eventually being filed against a tenant who, through no fault of his or her own, may not have understood what the rights and obligations were, and those are then on the tenant's records and make it harder for them to find housing going into the future. So this is an issue that has a broad, widespread impact on tenants, and we think there are compelling reasons to take action now to try to provide protection. Senate Bill 952-1 is the result of substantial concessions and amendments to the original bill. We think it provides some effective and immediate basic protections. It doesn't address the whole issue. We recognize we may not be able to do that this session, but we think that the amendments provide a good compromise. They would provide basically that notice to tenants can't go out until the date of the foreclosure sale, so no one can be told that they have to leave and by anyone other than the owner of the home. That's a basic protection for landlords as well as for tenants who are trying to maintain stability of housing. We also provide that the notice that is posted on the home or served on the occupant contains some specific language that addresses the tenant's concerns and provides them with referrals and information about where they can get information. We provide that tenants who are in month-to-month leases get 30 days notice before they have to leave. Tenants with fixed-term leases, the original bill proposed that term lease be able to continue till its natural expiration. The bill is, the amendments are a significant reduction in that proposal and would provide that only 6 months of that lease are preserved. So the 6 months, the new purchaser could give a 6-month notice to the tenant at the point of sale unless the tenancy would, by its own terms, expire before then. There's an exception to that, which is provided if there is a sale to the home to someone who intends to live there, in which case that purchaser who intends to reside in the home can give just a 30-day notice to the tenant. The next change is that with respect to eviction proceedings, the bill specifies that those court proceedings cannot be filed until the termination of the notice that was given under the bill. And significantly, the bill, the amendments provide some protection for tenants' security deposits. Often what we find is that tenants are struggling to go through these procedures. Under normal landlord-tenant law, they would be entitled to get their security deposit back from their landlord. Often in these circumstances, the landlord is nowhere to be found. What the bill does is provides that when the tenant gets a notice of foreclosure posted on the home or served on them, they have the right under landlord-tenant law to notify the landlord in writing that because of the foreclosure proceeding, they wish to exercise their option to have their security deposit applied towards any current owing rent. So it's a way of preserving the tenant's right in that security deposit without negatively impacting the new purchaser or the landlord who would have owed that money back to the tenant in the first place. There are a significant number of protections that we put into the amendments for purchasers, they are these. The bill only protects a specific small population of people who are residential tenants in residential homes that are in legitimate good faith rental agreements. So that's specifically provided for in Section 1 of the bill. The bill also provides that purchasers who come into the home after the foreclosure sale are specifically released from liability for any pre-existing issues that may have occurred or for in the home, and they're also removed from any liability for return of security deposits. We also provide that purchasers do not become landlords except in certain circumstances, if they accept rent or if they sign a new rental agreement or if they don't terminate the agreement as provided for by the bill. That's in Section 1, Sub 7. The bill also provides a sunset date so that it expires in 2014. We did that because we think that there's a current crisis in Oregon that is making it very difficult for tenants. It's foreclosures are happening frequently. Homes are on the market and vacant for long periods of time, and so there's an interest in having those homes occupied by legitimate good tenants and preventing that neighborhood blight and the harm to families. But we don't know how long that situation is going to last, so 2014 seemed to be a reasonable time period in which to move that protection forward. The only other things I would offer before I stop talking are that there are many other states that are looking at these protections. New Hampshire, New Jersey, and Washington, D.C. already have had longstanding protections for tenants in these circumstances. The state of Washington and the state of California recently passed legislation providing 60 days notice to tenants after the point of sale and foreclosure, and there are 13 other states with pending legislation. So we are taking a look at something that's important and that's having an impact nationally. I would also just point out that there are a number of large lenders that are already acting according to these principles because it turns out that it's better for them to have people paying rent and their properties occupied and maintained during the time period that they are hoping to sell rather than having them sitting vacant and deteriorating. So my colleague John Van Lanningham from Lane County Law, Legal Aid and Advocacy Center is in the room as well if you have any further questions, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Who's next?
Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, my name is Ari Rafkin, and I am a co-executive director of the Community Alliance of Tenants, and I'm appearing today in support of Senate Bill 952 with the -1 amendments. One of the things the Community Alliance of Tenants does is operate a renter's rights hotline where tenants can call when they are facing difficulty or have questions about maintaining safe, stable rental housing. And since the foreclosure crisis began, the number of calls that we have gotten from tenants in this kind of situation has skyrocketed. Before it happened, I don't think there was a time when we really got a call about this problem, and we're getting at least 4 a week now, which is a huge increase considering the number of calls we get. And even worse, there's no real good strategies that we can give to tenants who call with this problem. They don't have protections. These tenants get practically no notice that they're going to be forced from their homes or that their home is going up for auction. They usually have few, if any, resources to take time off work, find childcare, find a new place to live, scrape together money for first month's rent, last month's rent, security deposits, when they thought that they had a stable home to live in. When they've been paying rent all along, they haven't done anything wrong. This is exactly the kind of situation that makes people homeless, and this bill can help address that. It's fair, it's reasonable, and it allows hardworking families to maintain the safe, stable housing that they need to succeed. It'll give people additional time and additional resources to help maintain their housing. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Patrick?
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Patrick Wade. I'm a lawyer practicing in Eugene. Many of you may recall that I've appeared before this committee and others frequently on behalf of legislation sponsored by the Oregon State Bar, specifically as a representative of the Oregon State Bar debtor-creditor section. I want to preface my remarks here today by saying that the main thrust of this bill represents a significant policy change in Oregon that affects debtors and creditors in different ways, and as such, the debtor-creditor section does not take a position on the policy issues here today. And I will suggest that my remarks from here on reflect primarily my own thoughts on the subject as a practitioner who would be faced with implementing the changes that are proposed in this bill. I understand that there are other persons in the audience who will be testifying today, and they may bring to light some of the issues which have been part of the discussion that preceded the hearings today. I think it's not unlikely that a constitutional challenge might be raised to implementing this bill because of the transfer of property rights, which is a significant change in real property law. But putting that aside, I'd just like to go through the Dash 1 amendments and mention a few things. And I've had the opportunity only very briefly this morning to review the bill and to speak with advocates for the bill here. But in the Dash 1 amendments on page 3, about the middle of page, line 14 through 16, requires that the tenant provide notice to the trustee of the existence of a term tenancy, and I think as a practitioner I would encourage a change there to require the tenant to actually provide a copy of any written rental agreement or a summary of the substance of any oral rental agreement so that parties in interest will have some objective data to go forward making a decision. I understand that the on line 23 of that page, the 30-day notice would apply both to month-to-month tenancies and week-to-week tenancies, and I don't have a strong feeling on that on policy matter, but I don't see a reason why a week-to-week tenant should get 30 days notice, but that's probably not a significant issue. I think in the subsection, subparagraph D, which begins on line 30 of page 3 and carries over to the next page, can be improved because it's not clear to me that the FED action could be commenced before the end of a fixed term tenancy if, in fact, a notice has been given which terminates the tenancy because of the structure here where it says later out. But I think that's a technical issue that can be worked out. Finally, appreciate the efforts to make this bill clarify that the relationship between the occupant of the property and the purchaser is not one of a landlord and tenant under the Residential Landlord Tenant Act. But I would suggest that there ought to be the ability for a purchaser to accept compensation from the occupant for the use of the property, which is now owned by the purchaser, without becoming a landlord under the Landlord-Tenant Act for that period before the person is required to leave. And then I think that there ought to be a time limit established for the purchaser to exercise the rights of the purchaser to give the notice to the occupant, perhaps 60 days after the sale, so that if the purchaser fails to take any action to initiate the removal of the occupant after 60 days have passed, that might be a trigger to establish a landlord-tenant relationship. But I think as written, it would be unclear and invite litigation over whether or not the purchaser has timely exercised an option to remove an occupant. I think that's just to be clarified to eliminate those opportunities for litigation. I think throughout the other parts of the statute, there are consistent changes that should be made there. I think that summarizes my comments. Be happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. We're open for questions. Senator Boquist first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure who can quite answer this, or maybe somebody follow on. Can somebody explain this? Obviously, is it a bank foreclosure or mortgage foreclosure sale situation that we're discussing here? But how would this impact sheriff sales? I mean, as if the economic situation continues the same direction it's going. I mean, historically, sheriff sales increase where properties are seized for back taxes and then they're sold. How does that apply? How would this apply, law or change apply to those types of sales or seizures or whatever they call them?
Chair Pozanski, Senator Boquist, I'm not sure that I know the answer to your question, and I apologize that I wasn't able to bring that information today. I think the question is basically whether 86.755 covers sheriff sales, and if it does, then I would think it would impact those sales, but I don't have a good enough answer to your question.
Let's leave that question open. I'm getting different responses from people in the audience as to what they think, so let's just make sure we get the people
Thanks.
That may be able to cover this. What else?
I'm
all right. You're done.
I'm done.
Senator West and Senator Bormici.
I think there might be another constitutional issue here. A rental lease agreement is a private contract between a property owner or a property manager and a renter or a leaser. This bill would alter that private contract, if not in word and certainly in purpose, in that it would assign the contract to a new owner during which time, during the 30 days or 90 days or 180 days or whatever the tenant was required, the new owner was required to allow the tenant to stay in the property and pay rent. And the Oregon Constitution and the federal Constitution both prohibit laws that alter private contracts. Do you comment on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsett, I sympathize with the thought behind the question. I have to confess that I'm not a constitutional scholar, and I haven't researched this, but I suspect that there could be challenges based on impairment of contract as well as takings question with regard to the rights of the purchaser and as to the, what property rights are being acquired and being transferred as part of the foreclosure sale.
Okay. One other question for Ms. Hebb. I did not follow your explanation of how the security deposit would be handled. Could you clarify that for me?
Senator Brzezinski, Senator Wichita, yes, I'd be happy to do that. I also just wanted to offer on your question of the constitutional aspect is that I do have some research on that question that I'd be happy to provide to the committee. The tenant is not a party to the contract between the mortgage, the lender, and the landlord, the owner of the home, and I think that makes a difference in the analysis, but I'd be happy to get that to the committee to let you know. And I think that states that have provided these laws or passed these laws have analyzed that question. So I'll get that information. But to go to your question about the security deposit, the provision that we that's in the bill, it's section 4 of the bill, and it's on page 8 at the top. And essentially what it provides is that when a tenant receives notice that the foreclosure is going forward, the tenant may contact the landlord and let the landlord know in writing, according to the statute or to the proposal, that they would like their any prepaid security deposit that they have, they would like that deposit paid towards the value of their currently owing rent. And we did seek feedback from landlords as well as tenant representatives on the Landlord-Tenant Coalition, which you may be familiar with, and the responses were all positive to that proposal. So it's a means of hoping that the tenant doesn't, in the end, lose that security deposit. Of course, if the landlord ended up saving the home from foreclosure and wishing to pursue any claims against the tenant, they could charge another deposit and require that as part of their ongoing relationships. So I don't know if that answers your question.
This would create a right of action for the tenant to recover their security deposit from the landlord whose property may be in foreclosure.
Chair Pozanski, Senator Witsit, the current law, under normal landlord-tenant law, a tenant has a cause of action against a landlord if the security deposit is not returned correctly. But what we find in foreclosure is that that landlord is nowhere to be found, and they are often not solvent after.
How does this change that?
What this does, I think, Senator Prasansky and Senator Witsit, is that it essentially allows the tenant, rather than being under a continuing obligation to pay rent on the first of the month, for example, after having received the foreclosure notice, they can say to the landlord, I now know that I'm at risk of losing my security deposit because this foreclosure may go through, and so I would like you to pay that security deposit against my currently owing rent so that I'm not subject to an eviction notice for not paying my rent on the first. You've got my security deposit. Apply that towards the current rent. That's how it's meant to work.
This is prior to the foreclosure.
That's correct. It's at the point of the foreclosure sale notice, but prior to the foreclosure actual completion to the foreclosure sale. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When Senator Witsit asked this question, I thought you were going to say you supported this because you didn't want to alter the contract between the tenant and the landlord, which is what actually existing law does. So it's just an aside. I'm not a constitutional scholar either, but I'd be interested in knowing how that particular issue has been resolved. And you said there were other states, and it's my understanding that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac both extend tenant rights in a foreclosure, and also Massachusetts does as well. I just wanted to put that on the record that there are other states that have addressed this, so perhaps we could look at what they have encountered in terms of challenges to that contractual relationship, because right now the contract between the tenant and the landlord is altered by existing law. So that's already happening under existing law. And I think this recognizes that there's a contract that the tenant had to enter into
the lease. And so that led to my second question, which is, do you happen to know, Sybil, the percentage of people in Oregon who have leases versus month-to-month tenancies?
Thank you, Senator Brzezinski and Senator Bonamici. We don't know the exact numbers. Based on conversations with the Community Alliance of Tenants and other community partners, as well as statistics from our offices and looking at our client population, we can say that the significant majority of tenants are in month-to-month rental agreements. It's a minority that have term leases, so that extra protection would be available under the proposal to a small number of people, but I don't have the statistics.
I see, Ari, you're shaking your head. Is that
yes.
Your experience as well, that most tenants are in month-to-month?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Anything else? All right, thank you very much. Our next panel is going to be Angela Martin, Beth Kay, and Andrea Oxton. And whoever wants to start off, name and...
Perfect. Good morning, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. Happy tax day. For the record, my name is Angela Martin. I'm here representing Our Oregon. We work across the state on issues of tax and economic fairness. The upheaval in the mortgage market has been widely felt and is still evolving and far from over. The only good thing I can think of as I come to present testimony on this issue again is I no longer have to explain what subprime means. We've traveled a long way in these last 2 years. What was originally thought to be a problem contained within the subprime mortgage market now touches every aspect of consumer and commercial lending. And as we're learning here today, the impact touches thousands of families who have never even missed a house payment. These are the families who have had the misfortune of renting from a landlord whose property falls into foreclosure. As the number of foreclosures continues to increase in Oregon, and estimates are that we will be experiencing 55 foreclosure filings per day in this year, we know that the number of tenants impacted by this crisis will continue to grow as well. I echo many of the comments that have already been made. My colleagues before me did an excellent job expressing the details and the need for this policy change. We know that the impact of an unexpected eviction can be devastating on those truly innocent bystanders to this process. Tenants who are forced to move due to foreclosure face immediate and unplanned moving expenses. It's very unlikely that they will have the financial resources available to make that quick move. While preparing testimony last night, I had to ask myself the question, could I come up with $5,000, $3,000 on a moment's notice to prepare for moving expenses? And I think this is a struggle that most of us would have in these difficult economic times. That's why we support Senate Bill 952, the Dash 1 amendments, and in particular appreciate the addition of the protection of that security deposit and the ability to have that applied towards rent payments as the foreclosure process proceeds. I understand that much work has already been gone into this bill in an effort to minimize the impact on new owners, lenders, while maximizing the benefits for tenants and communities they live in. I appreciate all the work that's gone into this. I express again our strong support for Senate Bill 952, and with that I will close.
Thank you.
Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you this morning. For the record, my name is Beth Kay, and I am the Public Affairs Manager for the City of Portland's Bureau of Housing and Community Development, and I wanted to give you the city's perspective on this issue. It's very clear that we're in the midst of a national residential foreclosure crisis. In Portland, in 2007, Portland was 23rd in the nation in terms of foreclosures, with only 20 foreclosures. By 2008, Portland ranked 21st with 528. And for 2009, Portland is on track to have the fifth highest foreclosure rate in the nation. So it's a home issue for us. I don't know how many of those foreclosures are foreclosures of residences that are rented to tenants. The national statistic is that 40% of families facing eviction due to foreclosure are renters. One of the interesting things I saw in researching this issue was how many of the largest law firms in the nation have signed up to do pro bono work on this issue. So there's a report called Without Just Cause, where the WilmerHale Law Firm helped the National Center on Homelessness and Poverty and the National Low Income Housing Coalition pulled together data about the frequency of this. I just want to let you know that there's a very established segment of the legal community that is pointing out that this is a problem, and the fact that law doesn't currently address it doesn't mean that law shouldn't. The city is very concerned about the welfare of tenants who reside in residential properties that are entering foreclosure. As has been said, these tenants, through no fault of their own, may find that they're abruptly evicted from their apartments. A key fact that I want you to know is that the rental marketplace now has very little capacity to absorb them. Vacancy rates in Portland are at an all-time low. All those people who might have become homeowners and can't become homeowners because their credit isn't good enough or they can't get a mortgage in this environment, they're still renting. People who are not sure about whether their job is still going to be there, they're still renting. So the usual turnover that we see in the rental market isn't happening. We have foreclosure rates that are quite low. And rents are at historic highs. Low and moderate income tenants, in particular, will find it very, very difficult to secure substitute housing on a short notice. And, you know, in this economy, you need to live where you can get to work on time. We can't provide those options in the dimension that we would need to meet this demand. These tenants risk homelessness unless they're given fair notice and some time to relocate. Senate Bill 952 with the Dash 1 amendments takes a balanced approach to addressing this issue. And others have gone through the key provisions here concerning notice and protections against collusion. I want to speak to an issue that the city really has in common with the banks. The city is very interested in seeing that foreclosed homes can be purchased. We don't want blocks of vacant homes out there. Vacant homes are not good, especially at a time when we're cutting the budget for activities for youth, for police departments, and so on. We don't have the resources to keep areas of foreclosed homes secure and safe. We want these homes to sell. We want purchasers to get a fair deal. In fact, the city is frequently going to be a purchaser of the foreclosed homes. The federal government has sent us neighborhood stabilization funds to use to purchase foreclosed homes so that there aren't big blocks of empty properties. So, you know, the city is prepared to stand in the position of the landlord here. We think, on balance, this bill offers a good set of protections for the purchaser. For example, the purchaser is released for liability from pre-existing issues with the property and released from liability for returning the security deposit. The bill also clarifies that the purchaser is not a landlord unless the purchaser affirmatively acts as a landlord by accepting rent, signing a new rental agreement, or failing to terminate the tenancy as provided in the statute. This is a compromise. It's a split-the-baby compromise. And this split seems like a fair split. If you allow the new owner to take on the privileges of tenancy by collecting rent, then you must also hold the new owner to the obligations of tenancy, like furnishing a habitable property, et cetera, et cetera. Are we preparing to do that, or are we trying to get in here swiftly and neatly, do something that's going to provide some short-term protection for tenants in an unprecedented economic crisis that our nation's facing right now? The city of Portland has taken a number of steps to address the foreclosure crisis. For example, we've partnered with the Oregon Department of Consumer and Business Services, the Oregon Department of Justice, the Oregon Department of Housing and Community Services, and the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco to sponsor a foreclosure prevention event on May 2nd at the Memorial Coliseum in Portland. Such events, however, are primarily directed to homeowners. There's not really material there or help that we can give to renters at this point. We fund foreclosure prevention activities directed to homebuyers, not to renters. protecting renters of foreclosed properties is difficult to do at the local level. A state law, like Senate Bill 952-1, is the best way to address renter issues. Accordingly, the city strongly urges your support for Senate Bill 952-1. Thank you very much for the opportunity to appear.
All right, thank you, Andrea.
Yeah, members of the committee. My name is Andrea Oxton, and I'm an attorney at Portland State University appearing today in support of Senate Bill 952-1 amendments. I work in student legal and mediation services, and we're a free legal service for students, so our goal is to remove obstacles to students being successful in their education. As you can imagine, we see a lot of students with housing issues, and the foreclosure crisis has had a direct impact on students and their success in their education. Under the current law, there's very little we can offer students. Sometimes they've been provided no notice of the foreclosure, which means they're going to be forced to move in the middle of finals, in the middle of a quarter. They may not get the return of their security deposit. So not only are they facing the stress of moving, but they're having the added burden of all the financial strain that comes with moving on such short notice. We have also seen a situation where we have two people demanding payments for rent. So if a student has a rental agreement with their landlord that they think is what controls, and then you have a new party that's demanding payment, if the student chooses to pay the wrong person, they could have an eviction filed against them, which as spoken to, even an eviction that's eventually dismissed can have a real negative impact on your rental history. So then going into the market with that on your record can make it really difficult to find housing. As the law currently stands, there's just very little protection for students, and the residential instability that results can have a huge impact on their education, and I'd ask that you support this bill. Thanks.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Boquist first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Beth, you said in your testimony that Portland could be the fifth highest foreclosure rate in the nation. Since I don't have all the algebraic portions here, do you have a rough estimate of how many foreclosures that might be? If we did get to the fifth highest market, I mean, we're 528 last year and we were 21st.
I would say just roughly we're looking at 3 to 4 times right. This rate.
Thank you.
And that's very rough. And other markets are changing as well, which...
and I realize it's an estimate.
So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Senator
Wessett. Chair Brzezinski, it seems that when a new owner, pursuant to the foreclosure, has no rental agreement, and they have no rent, they have no tenant-landlord relationship, they're swinging in the wind. They have no legal authority to collect rent. They have no legal authority to evict someone if they don't have a rental. I mean, when I say no legal authority, I mean there are avenues, but no expedient avenue. They're simply hanging there.
Senator Whitsett and members of the committee, I think that puts the. A couple of responses. One is there's a problem, and we can't ignore it because the solution is difficult. Second is it puts the landlord really in the new owner. The new owner buys the property knowing that it's occupied. There has to have been notice to the trustee of the agreement. So the new owner walks into the situation going in knowing that there's a tenant there, and it puts the new owner in the position of so many landlords in the state who, property owners who rent their property on a month-to-month basis without a written rental agreement. It's not that unusual. And the law supplies some reasonable kinds of requirements.
Let me do this. I want someone else.
I think we need someone else up here that has, let's say, a little bit better legal understanding
Good.
Of this. John, I'd like for you to come up and answer this question. Thank you all very much. I hate to cut you off, but since you're
Fine.
Doing the PR
I
part, it's compared.
John.
Okay. John, if you heard the question, if you could respond to Senator Wissett after you put your name on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Wissett, John Van Landingham, Lane County Legal Aid. I work in the area of landlord-tenant law. So your question, I believe, and I want you to make sure that I have this correctly, is what's the status of the purchaser at the foreclosure sale vis-a-vis the tenant?
Yes, we heard testimony that the contract would not be imposed on them, so they would not have a landlord-tenant relationship, and they would not, in fact, have a contract, which leaves them, as I said, swinging in the wind as a landlord.
So Senator Przanski and Senator Wittsitt, at the foreclosure sale, many of the purchases are going to be made by the lender. Some of them are going to be made by an investor. Some of them will be made by someone who wants to live in the home, and the Dash 1 amendments try to address those relationships. I don't know what the percentages are. We've been told by the lenders that there are a significant number of people who buy them as investments. What Dash 1 does say is that the purchaser, whoever that is, whether it's a lender, investor, or someone who wants to live in the home, has the right to terminate the tenancy that exists in that home after the foreclosure sale by giving a 30-day notice if it's a month-to-month tenancy, a longer notice if it's a fixed-term tenancy. And what the Dash 1 amendments say is that the purchaser does not have the responsibilities of a landlord unless the purchaser does a couple of things. Enters a new written rental agreement, does nothing for a period of time, and you had Pat Wade say that we ought to clarify how long that period is, and I would agree with him that we need to make that clear in the Dash 1, or accepts rent. So our view is that if the purchaser is accepting rent, then the purchaser ought to have the responsibilities of a landlord in terms of maintaining the property. But the way the Dash 1s work is if you purchase the property and you don't want that tenant there, you give them a written notice and you terminate the tenants and you can file an FED. An FED is the shorthand term for filing eviction lawsuits. It's the quickest lawsuit in Oregon. Does that get at your question? So you have the, you
so
have the right to terminate.
If I understand your answer, then the new owner would not receive any compensation for the tenant living in that property for 30 days or for 90 days or 180 days, depending on the various, is that right?
Senator Wittsitt, that's correct. That's one of the issues that Pat Wade raised.
All right, other questions? All right, John, I want you to stay up here for a moment. Paul and Tim, whoever wants to go first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Paul Cosgrove representing the Oregon Financial Services Association, appearing in opposition to Senate Bill 952. First, I'd just like to say I agree with most of Mr. Wade's technical comments. There are a few other concerns on a technical nature that we would have as well, but I think rather than going into that, I'd rather just give you our major concerns. And as background, just to sort of set the stage, very few sales of foreclosed property in Oregon at this point don't revert to the lender. Said another way, almost all sales at foreclosure are purchased by the bank or other lending institution. There are a few that are purchased by investors, but I think almost everyone that you could ask who's involved in the foreclosure process, either as trustees or attorneys, would agree with that sort of factual background. So most of the impact of this is on banks and other mortgage lenders, and that's part of our concern. Secondly, only a few properties that are being foreclosed are not owner-occupied, or said another way, only a few of them have tenants in them rather than the borrower. I don't know that we have any basis to determine exactly how many there are, except for anecdotal basis on a one-by-one basis of terms of people who are doing foreclosures, because there's no data bank that would be able to confirm how many of the properties being foreclosed in any location or in any state are borrower-occupied versus tenant-occupied. But I think it's very clear that there are very few of these rental properties that are tenant-occupied that are going to be purchased by third parties who aren't looking for a vacation of the property and a fixing it up and trying to sell it, and that's the reason that they're buying it. So our point one is this will extend Oregon's already relatively lengthy, in fact, one of the longest foreclosure processes in the country for nonjudicial foreclosures even further. I did a bit of adjoining state research on how long an occupant of the property receives notice of foreclosure in our adjoining states. Idaho, the same as Oregon, 120 days. Washington, the notice of sale goes out 90 days before sale. California, 90. Arizona, 90. Nevada, 90. And I am pretty certain, although I wasn't able to check all the eastern states, that some of the eastern states are considerably shorter than 90 days. And I've even heard that one state, and I think it was Virginia, is as little as 30 days. So we have already a relatively lengthy foreclosure process. That initial notice at 120 days before sale is personally served on occupants or posted on the property. So that's the first time that a tenant receives notice in Oregon that there may be a problem at least 4 months before the foreclosure sale. And after the foreclosure, all parties, whether they be borrowers or tenants, have 10 days after the sale in which to vacate the property. And if they don't do so, whoever is the purchaser, often the bank, goes through the FED process that Mr. Van Lanningham mentioned, which is a fast lawsuit, but nonetheless a lawsuit that's going to take at least another 30, more likely 45 days in most courts in Oregon. So that's point one. This extends the process greatly. It also tends to put a damper on those few investors out there who are willing to buy properties in foreclosure, and I think it's in all of our benefit, both communities, lending institutions, and frankly the borrowers, to have a bidding war, if at all possible, at the foreclosure sale, because the excess beyond that's paid to the banks, owed to the bank, goes back, generally speaking, to the borrower. And this puts another kink in the process, another damper on it, and another disincentive for those few investors out there willing to bid on foreclosed properties to do so. Point two, this provides a good deal of new liability for purchasers, whether they be banks or private parties. Yes, the bill says that the purchaser is not liable for pre-existing conditions in the property, but if there is any compensation for the person staying there for the period of time, either 30 or 180 days, then we become a landlord without a written landlord agreement. And, more importantly, if there are problems that occur in the property, like the broken furnace, the typical kinds of things that can happen, the leaking roof, during that period of time, I think the bill, a fair reading of it, says that's our liability. We have become, by state decree, a landlord, in effect, at least from that point forward, for most kinds of liabilities that we'd be concerned about. Point three is this changes the current law about the priority of interest in property. As we sit now, Oregon and most other states establishes who has priority interest in property based on time. The first mortgage is ahead of the second mortgage. The first rental agreement is ahead of the second if there was a sublease agreement. All of those things are set, and in fact, what this does is, in this one particular case, it reverses the priority. The junior interest, the tenancy that's created after the mortgage or trustee is given priority. And that has certain real concerns, I think, for both title companies who are insuring these properties free and clear of these interests, and now we're going to create by state statute an interest that reverses that priority. And I think it does raise constitutional issues. Ms. Hebb talked about the constitutional issues with respect to landlords and tenants. There's a different kind of constitutional issue, and that is the modification of the contract that the lenders have and that title companies are insuring about who has priority of the property. And there is a legal opinion. I thought I'd brought it today, and I'm sorry I didn't, but I'd be happy to provide it to staff. It could be circulated from the Tennessee Attorney General when looking at a bill like this that came down on the side that this is not a constitutional provision because it is an impairment of that contract expectation, because it applies retroactively to mortgages that are on property already existing rather than prospectively. And point four is we don't have any concern about some portions of the bill. For example, additional notices to the tenants about the foreclosure is going on and they may have rights and who to contact are perfectly appropriate. We worked with this body in the last supplemental session to make a new form of notice to all borrowers involved in foreclosure that gave them in plain English or plainer English a notice of who to contact and what their rights are. So that's not a problem. And we certainly don't have a problem with the tenants being given rights vis-a-vis their existing landlord to say, I'm going to stop paying you rent, at least to the extent you have my security deposit or prepaid last month's rent. That's appropriate. That's a reasonable thing between the tenant and the landlord. I think I'll stop there and be happy to answer any questions. Although if I could comment on one question that came up earlier about what kinds of sales this affects. ORS 86755 and this series of statutes only affect non-judicial trustee sales. They do not affect judicial trustee sales, judicial mortgage sales, sheriff sales, tax sales, IRS lien foreclosures, or any other kinds of sales of property, usually done by a sheriff or a marshal. This only affects one particular process. It also doesn't affect contract forfeiture actions that are set up in a different statutory series as well. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Happy to answer any questions.
Tim?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association and the Independent Community Banks of Oregon. I see some of your members packing up, so I'll try to be very brief. You have my written testimony. I will would like to say that the association certainly agrees with the comments that Mr. Cosgrove has made. I would just add one point. You know, there was an earlier proponent of the bill talking about subprime and how folks now understand it. We still would maintain that subprime was never a big issue in this state and is not today. The problem, I did receive a request from one of your members to try to see if we could provide information on how many foreclosed homes were tenant-occupied versus owner-occupied, and I really was not able to come up with that answer. But what I did hear is that there are three main reasons today in Oregon that homes are being foreclosed on. One is an unexpected medical situation, high dollar costs. Second is divorce. And third is the economy. So when we lead the nation in unemployment, it's not a big stretch to see why we're moving up the line as far as home and foreclosure. So we do oppose this bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. I want to open up for questions. Senator Bolamici first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Martinez, in your written testimony, you mentioned that there could be a situation where somebody who's going to lose the property can lease it to a friend or relative at a bargain basement rate for a long term, leaving the foreclosing lender with the results. And it's my understanding that that has been addressed in the Dash 1 amendment. So I just wanted to point that out. And then also with regard to the point that was made about putting a damper on investors, I know that's certainly not the intent of the bill, and unfortunately there seem to be plenty of other properties that aren't occupied by tenants that investors can look at to purchase. So I just wanted to make that point that that's an unfortunate situation that we're in, that there seem to be plenty of properties that are homeowner occupied rather than tenant occupied. So that would just be a response to that.
Mr. Chair, just briefly responding to Senator Bonamici, Paul Cosgrove again. With respect to the sweetheart deal, if we could use that shorthand, that might occur, the problem is we don't have any idea what the deal is. We don't have any basis to know whether there's a written landlord-tenant agreement, an oral landlord-tenant agreement, a long-term lease, or otherwise. And in fact, what the Dash 1 agreements say, it had to be done in good faith. Well, who determines good faith? That would be a court. By the time we filed a court action to try to prove that a sweetheart deal was done in bad faith, which is a difficult burden of proof to start with when we weren't part of the negotiations, all these time periods would have expired anyway. So in fact, I think the Dash 1s do not give any effective protection against exactly that situation from our perspective. Thank you.
All right. John,
do you have anything? I would note that the current law, with or without this, already requires an FED. There will be a court involvement regardless of who purchases or who is in the unit. So you're going to have a court action. Good faith requirement is a standard of the Landlord-Tenant Act. It's been there since 1973. I don't think it's a difficult concept for judges to apply. It clearly, we added the good faith to address the legitimate lender concern that a homeowner would do something fraudulent and try to beat the system. But what are they getting here? They're getting a couple of extra weeks is beating the system here. They're still going to get evicted.
All right. So I've got a couple of questions. I just want some clarification. My understanding, currently under Oregon law, there's a 120-day notice that's given for the foreclosure before we commence.
Correct. At least 120. But
at least 120 days. Yes. Second, from what I heard Sybil Hebb say, pending in other states, California and Washington, I think I understood that prior to a purchaser taking control of the property, there would be a 60-day wait, or let's say transition period, before they'd be able to do so. And Sybil, is that what your testimony was?
Yes.
Okay. Third, regarding this, I'm going to call it double charging.
in the sense of you got a contract or at least something, or let's say there's a month-to-month, whatever it is, so the current landlord is receiving money from the tenant, then the new purchaser slash owner of the property then comes in control. Is there any prohibition to keep, when that transaction takes place, my limited knowledge would be that one person's rights to collect rent extinguishes and the other one potentially moves into the place to gather that. And I'm really kind of getting back to what we heard from the city of Portland, where you may have a tenant wondering who they are supposed to be paying or who can actually seek payment under that. I just want to know, is there any way that we now address that?
Mr. Chair, at least a partial answer to your question is, under current Oregon law, with a non-owner-occupied property, a foreclosing bank has the option to seek a court-ordered receivership. And in fact, with large multifamily, and this would affect large multifamily as well as single family based on the definition of dwelling, with large multifamily complexes, typically what happens is there is no notice of foreclosure given to the tenants because the property is going to be continued to be used as multifamily property. A receiver is appointed during the pendency of the foreclosure. The receiver then has court authority to show a tenant, I'm here to pay me. The receiver then becomes the landlord, has the landlord's duties, et cetera, and that continues throughout the foreclosure process. In other circumstances, the bank does not have the authority, legal authority, to demand rent. There is the possibility of confusion among tenants, and that's why we would support a better description of what tenant rights are in the notice provision of this bill. That's one that we do support, to explain what those rights are and responsibilities are and who should be paid. But the rent is still paid to the landlord until the date of the sale. Thereafter, the bank doesn't have the right to demand rent because we're not party to the rental agreement. The bank just has the right to demand possession at whatever time, currently 10 days or such other time as the law provides.
All right. Thank you. One other question. This is for John. Regarding good faith in the sense of the notice and all that stuff, if the notice has gone out 120 days prior to the notice of foreclosure, at least 120 days, if a landlord at that time entered into a new lease agreement with the tenant, would the courts look at that as being not good faith, trying to extend some time out and gather either more rent up front or position the tenant to be able to stay there longer, let's say beyond the time that they would have been able to without that type of agreement?
Mr. Chair, I think on the second part of your question, I don't believe that a court would have the authority to go beyond the timelines that this bill would allow, even if the landlord thought that.
Well, in the sense of the FED, you're saying this is going to go to a court in front of a judge. He or she's going to make these decisions. If that was presented that someone entered into a lease after that 120-day notice had been received, I'm just wondering how they're looking at
that. I would certainly think that a court would consider that as an element in deciding whether the agreement was entered into in good faith. There is already existing provision in the Landlord Tenant Act that requires a landlord of, I think, four or more units to tell a prospective tenant whether the property is in foreclosure. But it does happen that a homeowner in foreclosure will not tell a new tenant that the property is in foreclosure because they're desperate for money.
Right. Okay. All right. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you all very much. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 952? Not seeing anyone running up. We're closing the public hearing on 952. And, Council, I think that takes care of all of our today. And we'll be adjourned until tomorrow. I believe we're scheduled for 8 a.m. Thank you.